I am here with Ava Bustos-Schiff, who is from New York City and has come to my house in Austin to talk for Our China Stories. Hi, Ava.
Hi.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? How old are you and when did you come to the U.S. from China?
Okay, I'm 22. I was adopted from China in 1996 at about 12 months of age. And I was in an SWI.
In what province?
In Fujian province, in Xiamen.
And you grew up in New York City, correct?
Yes, I grew up in Brooklyn.
And you are now a senior at Smith College, majoring in computer science?
Yes. And it's been a very good experience for me.
Well, as the class of 1984 alum, I am very happy to hear it's been a good experience for you. So I thought we could start by talking a little bit. You were telling me about your first trip back to China when you were, I think, 11?
Yeah. So the summer after I turned 11, my parents and I went back to China for about a month. We were participating in a program that doesn't exist anymore, but through the program, we actually made some really close family friends that we've stayed in contact with. It was a program run by this family who's from Shanghai, and they were running sort of like a return heritage trip for Chinese adoptees and their families. And it was a 2-week program where we stayed in Shanghai. We did a little bit of like the kids had all these little activities. Some of them were about interacting with some older Chinese mentors, and some of them were like field trips we went on to like the old part of Shanghai and the tourist markets there. And the parents got to go to like a tea house, and we went and saw a silk factory where they were making silk blankets and things. So it was sort of your average return to country trip. Most of the people on the trip were the adoptees were younger, so it's sort of tailored to being fun, a fun introduction to the country without being too overwhelming, I think. And then after that, my parents and I stayed in Beijing for a couple of days. We went to Yunnan and Kunming for a couple of days, and incidentally, I got really sick and ended up in the hospital for 2 days. So that was interesting. Fortunately for us, at that time, my parents had hired translators because my Mandarin was not nearly as good as it is now. And the doctor that I saw in Kunming had actually lived and worked in Colorado for a couple of years. So that was very relieving to us.
What happened? Why do you think you got sick? Was it like a flu? Was it something you ate? Was it just being overwhelmed by the travel?
I'm not exactly sure what made me sick, but it was sort of your average, like little bit too high fever. And because China doesn't have localized doctor's offices like we do, everybody just ends up going into the hospitals to see doctors. So the entire time we were there, my dad was communicating with my doctors here, and they were, you know, saying that all the procedures that were happening were what they would recommend doing at home. It was just, you know, in a local hospital in Kunming, and was quite the experience.
How long were you in the hospital?
I was there for, I think, 2 nights, so 3 days and 2 nights.
You must have been scared.
A little bit. I think I was also overwhelmed because I didn't have enough Chinese to really understand what was happening, and I had never been hospitalized before. That trip in general made me get over my fear of needles, because I had all the 11-year-old vaccines, then all the vaccines to go to China, and then while I was in the hospital there, I had 3 IVs and two hip jabs with something. I don't know what it was. But yeah, that's kind of how that experience went.
So was that toward the end of the trip or in the middle? Like, did you, like, get out of the hospital and then resume your tour of China?
Yeah, so that was in the middle of the trip. So after that, I think, was when we went up to Beijing. And my parents had arranged for us to stay in this small town by a more rundown section of the Great Wall. And that was another experience in and of itself, because I actually ended up getting my period for the first time while we were there. And of course, we didn't have a translator at that point, and so my mom was trying to help me find the things I needed to take care of that, and playing charades with the hostesses. And eventually she just ended up drawing something and was like, yeah, we kind of need those.
And did they hook you up?
Yeah, but it was an interesting experience. I think it definitely makes it so you don't forget the first time you've gone back when things don't go according to plan.
So a lot happened in this trip, and I wonder, did you have any kind of epiphany about identity, or was it really more, I'm 11, I'm seeing the place that I'm told I was born, and it's cool, and now I'm in the hospital, and now I've got my period, and I don't have time to think about identity?
So we did go back and visit my SWI on that trip, and I had asked my parents to do it. They were very good at making sure I wanted to do it, and none of us knew what to expect, and I'm very grateful to my parents for arranging the next day as just an empty day, and it allowed us all to process, because when we went back, the director at the time had been at the SWI when I was adopted, so she vaguely remembered our group of children being adopted. Unfortunately, the nanny who cared for me was on break with her family, so we didn't get to meet her. But while we were there, they gave us a tour, and I just remember walking through all the rooms and looking at the conditions they were living in, and sort of having that what if moment, like, what if I had not been adopted, I would be living here, and how different that would be. And it was sort of the first time I had been confronted with the what if feeling in such a upfront way. And we ended up getting a bunch of clothes to donate back to the SWI, and then I think it was either the next day or the day after we went and visited what is recorded as my find site in the in my file, and that was what used to be a railroad track in like this sort of market area, and that location has actually really changed today. When I was a junior in high school, I went back and I studied abroad in China for a year, and during that winter break, my parents came to China, and we went back to Xiamen, and when we went back to my find site, we found that they had turned it into a park that was talking about the history of the railway line. So that was really interesting, and I didn't know how to take that in. Sort of at the time, I just sort of decided that I was going to walk down in between the tracks and sort of just film as much of that as I could.
So when you were 11 and you had that first bout of what if, when you were at the SWI in Xiamen, in Fujian province, we should say, what did the what if feel like? Was it a sad feeling? What is it? Sort of amusing feeling? Was it? I mean, can you talk a little bit more about what was going through your head?
I don't know if I would say it was a sad feeling, but it was definitely this conflicted feeling of like, well, why was I given to a family? And I think at that point, I didn't yet know that my parents didn't know that I was a special needs child at that point. So it sort of was this weird feeling of, was I chosen for international adoption because I was a special needs child, or like, why are these older children who, at that time, I don't think I knew what the age for placing out of eligibility for adoption was. And I think when I got home from that trip, I don't know if I felt guilty or more like I had a sense that I wanted to try to help some of the kids that were still there. So I spent the next couple of years where I would spend like an hour a day on Holt International's website looking at the waiting child list for China and just sort of seeing who was close to aging out, who was, you know, still there, what kinds of kids were there. And I realized that a lot of the older kids were kids with special needs. And then I actually was able to communicate to my parents that I wanted to help a child in China. Actually, it started out as I wanted them to adopt me a sibling because I'm an only child. That didn't work. But we did end up sponsoring, or we ended up donating some funds to benefit this one particular kid who was still under Halt's, I don't know how you would say that, but it was Halt's duty to find them a family. And so we had learned that she had been diagnosed with the same condition that I have, and so it felt to me like something I should do because I couldn't physically help her by giving her a family that had the support and the care that I had gotten, but we could help her pursue her dreams and her passions. So we bought her a dance outfit because she really liked to dance. And then I think a year or so, or within like 6 months, she got adopted. So that was really exciting.
Were you able to keep up with any information about her when she was adopted?
No, because we hadn't like formally like sponsored her in the sense that we hadn't sponsored all the costs for her care while she was there. But it was just something we did because I felt the need to help somebody that was still in that situation that I could have been in had I not been adopted as an infant.
So it sounds like sort of the question that it raised for you was, why me? Why me and not them? I'm younger, they're older, they're going to be here longer. And you mentioned that your parents came to understand that you had a special need. Are you comfortable telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I've been diagnosed with cerebral palsy, but I wasn't diagnosed until after I was placed with my parents and we were back in the U.S. Because at a year of age, I was on the smaller side, which I guess my parents expected, getting a kid from an SWI. But what was concerning to them was that after they had me home for about a month, maybe a little less, they were noticing that I was not really moving on my left side. And so I wasn't hitting those physical milestones that babies, happy, healthy, active babies should be hitting. And so they started seeking medical advice to try to figure out what it was. I was tested at St. Vincent's Hospital in Manhattan, and then we did an MRI. Actually, it's funny because my mom took pictures of it that I just found this year. So the conclusions is that basically the right side of my brain didn't develop normally, and so that's what's causing the cerebral palsy in my case. I'm really fortunate in the sense that I'm still very high functioning and I can almost pass for not having it, but I've been receiving treatment for it since I was a baby. The interesting story with that was because Halt didn't know that I was a special needs child when they placed me. Evidently, my dad told me a story where after they got the diagnosis confirmed, Halt gave them the option of refusing to take me because I was special needs and because my parents in their application had said they didn't want a special needs child of any form. And when my dad was telling me the story, he was like, at that point, you were already ours and there was no way we were giving you back. So,
how old were you when your dad told you to explain this to you?
They'd always explained that I was adopted. I think when I found out about the possibility of them starting the process over, I was, I think, a senior in high school. Because my parents have always had the philosophy that I'll ask what I want to know. And so there's, in our office space in our apartment, there's a file cabinet of files that are from my school years, but also in the back of that file cabinet, my dad had placed my adoption packet that they sent to Holt in there for me to find when I was ready. He never told me it was there, but he didn't try to hide it from me. He left it somewhere where he felt when I was ready, I would find it. And I guess that was my senior year of high school.
So you found this kind of on your own without direction from your parents. Did you find in the packet the notification of some kind that, hey, you know, she's special needs. We know you didn't want special needs. Do you want to send her back? Or in asking your dad about the contents of the file, he added and explained that additional information to you?
So all I found in the file was the original adoption paperwork they sent in. And the part that interested me was the medical questionnaire, because they had said they don't want any form of the possible list of conditions that a child could come with. And so I was like, I brought the folder to him, and I said, if this is how you filled out this sheet, how did you end up with me and the fact that I have a very mild case of what can be a very severe diagnosis? And that's when he told me that story.
So you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I imagine as a parent that could be a really like whoops moment. My fear, if it were me, would be that my daughter would suddenly feel that she hadn't been wanted. And I wonder if, you know, if it was awkward or difficult, or if it sounds like you and your folks have a really close and very open relationship. So it doesn't sound like it made you have a crisis of faith about their love for you, but maybe it did. I don't know.
I wouldn't say it gave me a crisis of faith in their love for me. I think what it did was, for a while, it made me sort of, I think it just gave me a new perspective on some of the incidents and things that we had gone through in growing up as a special needs child, and some of the, like, why they weren't, like, completely, they weren't the type of parents to, like, read every single piece of literature about the diagnosis. And I think that was because at the time they weren't prepared for that, and then they sort of just took it in stride and have done what they can without going overboard and without not without doing too little.
So I want to make sure that I'm hearing you. I'm going to tell you what I heard and tell me if I'm right. It sounds like what you're saying is your parents, they got news they didn't expect to get. They were totally and completely, there was no question at all that you were their daughter and they were going to do everything, whatever they had initially filled out in the abstract in thinking about a special needs child. In the particular with, you know, in the moment, with their daughter, there was just no question. They were going to do everything they needed to do, but they also weren't going to kind of catastrophize this news.
Yeah, I would say that's exactly how they took it. Because they immediately, like I said, they immediately got me into physical therapy and occupational therapy. They even had me in speech therapy, although I didn't really need it. They just wanted to make sure that anything that could come up wasn't going to be an issue. And that's sort of the way my life with them has been. It made me a very busy child to have to go to occupational and physical therapy once a week. Like, my friends would be like, well, let's have a play date. And I'm like, I have to go to this. And so I used to complain about being really busy, but I'm glad that they put in the time and the effort.
So how do you regard the cerebral palsy now? How do you think about it in terms of being part of who you are? How much space does it take up in your brain?
I'd say it takes up about as much space as being adopted takes up in my brain. And for me, they're both a very big part of my identity. And it's interesting because my boyfriend has asked me a number of times, like, if you could change anything, would you? And really, I wouldn't, because in a way, having to deal with a physical disability that makes doing certain things more difficult and gives me more limitations on what I can do, I have a lot more of those moments of, oh, look, I can do this. And I think some of the best moments that have made me physically and emotionally stronger have come out of it. And that's sort of how I see it. I don't really see it as a hindering factor in my life. I can drive. We just had to find a different way for me to learn how to drive. And that worked well. Anything I set my mind to, I can. And my parents are really supportive. They just want to make sure that I'm not getting into something too fast. So the most recent event that sort of brought the possibility of, am I getting in way over my head, was that earlier this year, so like back last May, I approached them with the idea that I wanted to get myself a service dog, and they were really concerned that I was getting in way over my head, and they were like, okay, well, if this is something you want to do, show us the research, like, find all the stuff. And what they hadn't known was that it was something I was looking at for about 3 years, and then I, in the last year, really found an organization that I wanted to go with, and so we just completed the application for that, so we're waiting to hear. But they've been really supportive through it, and I'm really glad.
And tell me about the service dog. What do you hope that the service dog, or expect that the service dog, will be able to be particularly helpful with?
I think for me, because there's so many pieces of my identity that I don't always know if I want to share with people, because I have, at least now that I'm an adult and I don't live with my parents full time, I have the choice of, you know, introducing the fact of, am I adopted? I have, for the most part, the choice of, do I want to introduce the fact that I am, you know, that I have a physical disability? And so for me, the dog will help physically by turning on light switches, opening and closing doors, you know, getting things that I drop, but also as a way for me to feel more comfortable out in public settings. I don't really like big crowds. I don't like change, and I'm not very, like, I need to be very planful and have a plan. So the dog will just help me feel more comfortable in my environments.
And in a way, the dog sort of, I'm imagining the dog, the presence of the dog also, without you having to tell a story, without you having to make known that you do have certain physical challenges, the dog sort of helps present that without the burden of having to, you put that out there. You know, I wonder if that might also, you know, always wondering, do I say something? Do I not say something? Well, you don't have to say anything, right?
Yeah. I think also because people are very receptive to dogs, sometimes a little too much so for assistance dogs, where if I don't know what to say when I'm meeting a person, I tend to be really shy in new situations, then the dog will serve as an icebreaker and as a communication starter. And I think that that's important in any life situation, giving these two different parts of my identity, because they're both identities that come with larger mainstream social expectations, and I don't always feel like I fit in those. And so how do I change people's perceptions of me within those identities without getting into an uncomfortable situation? And I think that the dog will be a good conversation starter, and so that I can, you know, we can talk about the dog and see if they're just curious because they want to say hi to the dog, or if they're actually curious enough to want to learn and improve their perception of these identities. And that will be a really good gauge for me on how to talk and share about my identities and my experiences.
So will the dog live with you on campus?
Most likely I won't get placed with a dog until at least 6 months and probably further from that. The organization that I'm applying through is called Canine Companions for Independence, and their wait list is generally 1 to 2.5, 3 years. But they just opened a new facility in Irving, Texas, 2 years ago. And so that wait list tends to be smaller, because you have to have a residential history in the state of Texas. So in working with them, they're anticipating that I will be able to get a dog sooner. But I'm willing to wait however long it takes.
Well, that's exciting. Will you send me a picture of you with your dog?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you have a name picked out?
So they actually name their litters. Their naming scheme for each litter is that each litter is assigned a letter, and all of the puppies' names start with that letter. So they, as an organization, breed, raise, and train the dogs, which is an expensive at least $50,000, and they provide these dogs to their clients free of charge, which is a really amazing part of this organization. But they also provide postgraduate services, and what that means is, like, they maintain ownership of the dog. It's another way that they don't cover you the charge, but they are there for support and help and in any of the problems you could come up with. For example, like, for their graduates out in California with all these fires, they have an emergency services line, so, like, they were helping if graduates needed help finding resources of places they could stay with a dog and things like that. The organization exists, their post-placement services exist to help you with things like that, but also to create a community that sort of, like, exists in the adoption community, where we share our stories and we give advice and all of that. So it's the same type of thing, just for my other identity.
That is so cool. And one of your other identities is that you're also, like, a cross New Yorker Texan like me, because you have family you mentioned in Texas, hence the Irvington connection. So there you go. So we were also talking earlier about your return to China when you were older, and I wondered if we could talk a little bit about what that was like.
So my junior year of high school, I, through my school, participated in school year abroad in their China program, and I did my junior academic year abroad in China, in Beijing. I stayed with a host family, and we took lots of little travel trips throughout the year, and it was a really great chance for me to experience what life in China is like, in the sense of being a part of the daily commute. And also, at SYA China, the school is not integrated in the sense that we don't take classes with the Chinese students, but we are hosted by a local Chinese high school. And so we have the opportunities to interact with Chinese students. And also on our trips, we got to go and visit some other schools and interact with some kids. But what was interesting for me was, when I planned that I wanted to go on this trip, I wanted to go because I thought it would be a good opportunity for me to get to know China a little bit better and to know what the daily life was like, and going back to that what if. But while I was there, I didn't expect to have an adoption identity crisis. And I guess what I mean by that is that I didn't expect that being in China and living, quote unquote, like a Chinese person would bring up all of these conflicting emotions of, well, what if my life had been different and what if I had stayed in China. And I'm very grateful that I've lived in the U.S. because from what I understand about the Chinese society, it is a lot harder for disabled individuals to lead independent and more have equal opportunity. And so for me, that's always been a grounding factor in the sense that I've into the fact that I was adopted and that I do belong here and that I don't have to feel guilty about being adopted. But also when I was in China, it was weird because I would be riding the bus with my friends from the program who were all American students and for the most part Caucasian. There were a couple of other adoptees, but I would be riding the bus and we would have these conversations and we'd be talking in English, and everybody on the bus would just be staring at me, and it sort of brought up these feelings of, oh yeah, that's right, this is totally not normal. Like, everybody thought I was, like, super amazing and super special because I was speaking English without an accent and I was, had high fluency and, you know, keeping up rapid conversation, and also that I was reading, you know, high level books. I think at the time, I remember the first trip to China, I was reading My Sister's Keeper, which was slightly fat, and people were really surprised about that. But it was just interesting because, in a way, while I was having these what if scenarios in my head, I was also, my sense of the people's reaction to children who were adopted from China internationally was changed a lot. Our media here in the U.S. portrays that we're unwanted children, and that that's very much how China's society sees us. And living and being there with the people, that's not their reaction. You know, a lot of the time, Chinese people really want to become as developed as the Western superpowers. And so for them, the idea that you got to go abroad and you got to live in a Western country is actually really cool. And I kept hearing that I was lucky, which I think if I heard the same thing in the U.S., I would feel weird because most of the time I hear that in the, oh, you were saved context. But like in China, it's just like you were afforded a great opportunity. And I think that that's interesting. I also, at the end of my junior year in Beijing, SYA does what they call an independent learning project, where it's the culmination of all the language practice that you've been given. And it's a research project for the last month. And my group was researching adoption. So we went and visited a quote-unquote foster home. And I say that way because that's the government deems it a foster home, because it's the one that we went to was run by a woman from Texas who moved to China. And there, facility mostly housed special needs children, and that was interesting because we got to interview some of their workers and find out what their perspective was. But we also conducted just public street polls, and a lot of the people of the younger generation being like in their mid-20s to early 40s, they're very open about the topic of adoption, and they see it as a very positive thing. The older generation, I would say the generation that at the time when I was there was in their later 40s to early 60s, they have a very different view of adoption because they were still part of that generation where the family planning campaigns were still widely happening when they were having children of their own and stuff. And actually, my host mom told me an interesting story was that the family in the apartment next door, their daughter had actually been adopted in what, I'm not sure under what circumstances, but she didn't know she was adopted. And she was about 25 to probably 30. And it was interesting because I was like, why is my host mom telling me this when she, their daughter, doesn't even know it? And so it was this weird feeling of the older generation still having that need for secrecy about what adoptions had taken place under the influence of the family planning campaigns, but that the younger generation is very open to the idea of they've grown up with knowing that so many of us have been adopted internationally, and just thinking that that's a wonderful thing. So it was very interesting to see the generational differences of opinion.
That is really interesting. So your host mom, was really of a generation where she remembered and experienced families sort of in informal adoptions in a lot of cases to try to hide over quota children, right? Yeah. This is what we were talking about Kay Ann Johnson's book, and this is what she, you know, talks about in her research. So I think I haven't talked with anyone who's really articulated the difference in the generations and how they, younger people, regard adoption without that level of secrecy. Did you get any sense that, you speak Mandarin. You had studied Mandarin, and what was your fluency like? Were you able to converse with people while you were there?
So the SYA China program is a program that allows you to come to China with no Mandarin at all. That wasn't my case. I had started learning Mandarin when I was really little. My parents put me in classes and left it up to me whether I wanted to continue. I eventually decided when I was in first grade that I didn't want to continue because I had done the basics like five times over. And I knew that my school had a Chinese language program starting in middle school. So I started learning Chinese in seventh grade. So by the time I was a junior in high school, when we got to China, they gave us a language proficiency placement exam, basically. I just said that way more formally than it really was. They sort of basically just asked, like, you know, what textbooks have you used, and like had us do a little written test. And I was placed in the second highest level. So I had lots of conversation. When I got to China at that point, I would have said that I had conversational fluency. And that was really good for me because they placed me with a host family where my host mom spoke absolutely no English, and her daughters were in their late 30s, early 40s, and didn't live at home anymore. So I really was sort of on my own. The first night, one of my host sisters came by to make sure I was settling in. But I just remember I would come home in the evenings and we would have dinner and we would start talking about stuff. And at the beginning, I was so flustered and like just overwhelmed by being in China that it would take us an hour to get through a simple conversation because I had forgotten all my bigger concepts and words in Mandarin. But then eventually, because I was there during the 2012 election, my host mom was curious about the U.S. election system and how that worked, and I had accidentally brought a pocket constitution with me to China because I had it in my backpack from U.S. history the previous year. So one night over dinner, using my pocket constitution as sort of a little guide, I tried to explain the voting system to her. It was an interesting experience. But by the end of it, I was proficient enough that I started asking her about her experience during the Cultural Revolution because she was a child and who grew up in that time period. And she said that she didn't go to school until she was 8 years old, that her family sent her brother, who was younger, to school before that. But it was interesting because my host mom's particular experience was that after she did school, she became an educator. And it was just really interesting to hear her talk about it firsthand, kind of like we were saying that this project is a way for us to share our experiences firsthand. It was interesting to hear from somebody who had experienced such a major event in history that has such a giant impact on the way that Chinese society is.
And these conversations about the Constitution, about her experiences as a girl in the Cultural Revolution, were happening in Mandarin?
Yeah. She did not speak any English. Like, if I got flustered in the middle of my explanation or whatever, and I tried to use, like, a tiny English word, it would literally just go in one ear and out the other. Like, she did not have any understanding of English at all. On the other hand, I was able to, on the weekends when my host sisters would come around, one of them had a kid who was, I want to say, 7 at the time, would come around, we would go and do things, and they spoke English, so I had, I would say, the same level of conversations with them, but it was happening both in English and Chinese. But I really enjoyed that my host mom didn't speak English, because it really forced me to use my Chinese, and it was really cool, because the textbooks we were using covered the Cultural Revolution and stuff. So I was able to, like, put the vocabulary that we were learning in class into use in having these conversations with her.
What do you think, like, what did people make of the fact that you spoke Chinese? Did people seem pleased that you were able to speak Chinese once they realized you had grown up in the United States? Do you think that there was an expectation that you would speak Chinese, or there was an expectation that you wouldn't speak Chinese and then people were surprised that you could?
I think for the most part, when I was in China, it was weird because, like, for me at that age in the U.S., I was still having the struggle of, do I tell people I'm adopted? Because I was still living at home at the time. But what was interesting was when I was in China, I had no trouble telling random strangers I was adopted. And for the most part, they were really receptive to that. As for expectations of speaking English, I never really told any of the strangers and people that I met that I was from the U.S. So I guess for them, my level of Chinese was sort of just normal. And, like, other than the people on the bus who were, like, listening, experiencing me having a regular English conversation with some of my friends, there wasn't really this expectation. They were just sort of in awe because they really couldn't tell that I hadn't grown up there. They probably could tell that I probably hadn't grown up in Beijing or hadn't, because since I'm from Fujian province, which is a southern province, and, like, Beijing is a northern district province, I think it's actually a province, they're taller, so I still had the short thing when I was in Beijing. But there's a really interesting thing that happened. I was on a train on the, so I was very comfortable using the subway system in Beijing, which was really interesting, and is really weird. Even though New York City has a subway system, our subway system is 24/7, whereas in Beijing, all the public transportation shuts down at 11, so if you're not home by then, you are going to be stranded. But what was interesting was one encounter I had on the subway was there was this family that was visiting Beijing because I think the dad was doing some international business, and they had a little phrase book with them, and they were stumped with the concept in the Chinese language of measure words. And I guess it's just because Chinese doesn't conjugate, and the quantity of one thing isn't the same as the quantity of another thing. Chinese uses measure words to distinguish types of objects. And so I was trying to sort of explain that to this family on the train, cause I thought it would help them. I was basically, cause they were staring at their phrase book and a little confused. And I basically said, if you don't know what the actual measure word is, you're good with using ge, which is sort of just a general measure word and is used for things that don't fall into the other categories. But it was interesting because after the family had gotten off the train, this man who looked like he might be a migrant worker was, like, telling me off for, like, telling the... for helping that that tourist family out. And it struck me as an odd reaction to have. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and because we had in our cultural history class, because we had regular Chinese history class, and then we had a more like cultural history class, we had learned that a lot of those migrant workers like come from, you know, rural families who they don't have the opportunity to go to school. And so it sort of struck me as, oh, this guy is upset because I'm teaching these foreigners something that he didn't have access to. And so it was just a slightly weird way to experience that cultural, that social cultural thing that happens in China, where a good portion of the population is illiterate or and doesn't have high education, and it how weird it is that there's so many more foreigners that have a higher level of Chinese proficiency than a majority of the Chinese population.
And I'm gathering that he didn't know that you had grown up in the United States. Was the migrant guy assuming that you were, you know, you live in China and we're helping this tourist family? So there's a sort of added layer of kind of irony to it.
Yeah, I didn't speak to this worker before the incident happened. It was just him reacting to the incident. So to his knowledge, yeah, I had grown up there, so he didn't have any semblance of the fact that I was indeed myself a foreigner.
And when you would tell people that you were, you know, earlier you mentioned you would, you know, you didn't have any problem telling people you were adopted, and you would tell, you know, folks you were adopted on those conversations, I assume, were going on in Mandarin. Do you think that people assumed that you were adopted within China? In other words, did they understand that you were internationally adopted? Was it, did you ever, in other words, I guess what I'm getting at is, what I'm wondering is, you know, when my daughter went back with us, we were talking about this earlier in June, she's 11. One of the things that she and I talked about that really struck me when we were in Nanjing walking down the street, and she kind of got ahead of us and I couldn't see her. And I got nervous, you know, because we were with a school trip, and she was the only Chinese kid in her. There were two Chinese kids, you know, then in her immersion class, and she was the only one who'd gone. And so I called out her name just to make sure I kind of knew where she was. And she looked really annoyed with me, and I caught up with her, and we talked about it. And I said, I think I know what just happened, and I'm sorry. Am I right about this? Was it that you were blending in? And she said, yes. She said, you know, I think she just, in that moment, she just looked like everybody else on the sidewalk. And I'm just wondering if there were, I'm wondering with your ability to speak Mandarin, and that the assumption wasn't necessarily made, if that was comforting to you in some way, or something you were sort of playing around with almost, you know, in terms of belonging, not belonging. And I may be kind of projecting my own experience onto this.
I would say that was definitely a part of it. I think it was like, I'm not one of those people that relish the, oh, you're so special feeling. So for me, like, it was a little weird. I don't like being the center of attention. So it was a little weird being on the buses and talking to my friends and being stared at the entire time. I think with a lot of the people that I would tell that I was adopted, it sort of depend the circumstance, but I think generally when I was telling people that I was adopted, I was telling them that I was adopted by Americans. In regard to the experience you had with your daughter, my first trip back when we were in Beijing, we went to the lakeside market area. I get that one confused with the other, with the other tourist spot, so I'm not going to try to say which one is which. But there was this experience where, because we had been doing a lot of walking and I was getting tired, my dad was holding my purse, and I wanted to buy something from one of the little vendors or something, and so I went to reach for my wallet out of my purse, and I got told off by this Chinese guy. And it was really funny, because, like, I was like, okay, so whatever, you're telling me off, like, this is not an issue, whatever. So I just, like, let it go, and then I tried again, and the guy told me off again, and then my dad realized the second time, and he was like, no, it's fine. But it was just kind of interesting, because I was blending in, and then had this weird encounter. But I think in terms of, is it nice to blend in? I think when my family and I were traveling over that winter break, and my parents decided that my Chinese was proficient enough for me to play translator. It was interesting because we went to visit this little temple somewhere, and Chinese people are known for being obsessed with foreigners, and particularly white-skinned people. And I say that in that way because in Chinese supermarkets, you can literally find whitening cream. And so when we were at this temple, it was a smaller temple, so it wasn't really a tourist attraction. And so my parents and my friend from the SYI program were the only white people there. And, like, there was this, I think they were a high school group, they might have been a middle school group, but visiting the temple. And they just, like, mobbed my parents and my friend, and they wanted to take pictures. And I was like, you know, I'm kind of glad I'm not in that giant mob right now. And then, my dad told me to tell them that I was also American, and then they, like, included me in the mob, but I was kind of enjoying not being in it. So it started that weird complex where I knew that I wasn't fully Chinese in that, in my experiences and in my daily routine going about life in Beijing for that year, but I also knew that I wasn't fully a foreigner. And so I remember going through the experience and being like, I kind of don't really fit in either of these categories. And it wasn't uncomfortable. It was just different, I think, because in the U.S., it's like, you're very, either you are Caucasian or you're not, and you are adopted or you're not. And there wasn't that fine line in China, and it was kind of nice experiencing that for a change.
I wonder, like, now, with all these experiences you've had that are really so fascinating, and being able to have, I think, an experience in China of real depth because you had the language, so it allowed you a kind of anonymity in a way, a cloak of anonymity. We were talking about about Harry Potter earlier. You had your invisibility cloak in a way. And so you could kind of be in both spaces. You know, I just wonder, like, if this has informed, or how it might have informed, how you think about being adopted from China, about the whole kind of package of adoption from China, the conversation around adoption, the narrative around abandonment. We know so much more than we did before. And I just wonder sort of what goes on in your head around some of that.
That's a very multifaceted question. I think I'm going to start by saying that my philosophy about where I am in my adoption identity and my adoption story is that, for me, it's always been about finding as much information as I can so that I can understand the issue from as many ways as possible. Because when I was younger, you know, I grew up with the classic adoption story that's provided by our society, our American society and our American media, but I always knew that that wasn't the whole story, and I wanted to find the other side. It started for me by engaging in things with other adoptees, like families with children from China, which we participated in a lot when I was growing up, but also in finding different media sources from different countries and seeing what the different media put out. And then as I got older, participating in research studies by other adoptees. There's one by Hannah Joy Sachs that I was a part of, connecting with academics like yourself and like Professor Johnson, who I met through an FCC event. But reading her book was really helpful for me in the sense that it provided the other side of the narrative. I think because our media always portrays it as the decision to give up a child, because that's how adoption works in our country. But that's not how it worked at that time period. It's not how it works now, even in China. And so I think having the other side of the narrative, particularly Professor Johnson's book is about the coerced decision under the influence of the family planning campaigns, was very helpful for me, and it helped me see the situation in a different light. Because I think a lot of adoptees, and including myself when I was younger, you have that feeling of, well, why didn't my birth family want me? And because that's the way that the traditional narrative sets it up. They say, you know, the traditional narrative says you were given up, you were abandoned. And, you know, both of those two ways of saying it string the narrative very differently and have profoundly different effects on different people. For me, I don't categorize myself as somebody who has major abandonment issues. Do I have insecurities about being alone and having, you know, being wrenched out of where I am? Yes, but I don't think that that manifests in the typical and clinical abandonment issues. The other part of could you restate the question just so I can...
No, you're answering the question. Really, it was how you think about being adopted from China in the context of all these experiences you've had. And it sounds like what you're saying is one of the things that becoming familiar with K.N. Johnson's research has done is given you an appreciation and an understanding that this is about... that all of this has happened in the context of policy, of government policy that forced people to make decisions about relinquishing children, and that many of these relinquishments were not relinquishments. They were, you know, outright confiscations. But that the whole notion of abandonment as a free decision, you know, is just sort of a fallacy, and that you've gotten that through understanding more about from K.N. Johnson's work and some of the other research you've done.
I would say what I wanted to add to that was we were talking when we initially started thinking about including me in the project was the documentary Somewhere Between, and watching it prior to reading Professor Johnson's book and watching it post-reading Professor Johnson's research had a profoundly different effect on me. And the part that I'm referring to is the part where Haley and Anne go to London and they meet with the Korean adoptee who's that academic, and he presents the idea of that in the academic world, there are a lot of people who say that transnational adoption should not continue. And I remember initially, before I was introduced to Professor Johnson's research, I was very upset at the thought that people didn't want transnational adoption to continue. And then that particular individual went on to include the fact that because Korea has been open for adoption way longer than China, that the academic research in the field for Korea has shown that a lot of those children were not abandoned and not voluntarily given up to the adoption system. And he was saying that, you know, we can't be sure of the Chinese system. Then, after reading Professor Johnson's book and being introduced to her research, it was sort of presenting the same idea that the academics had found for Korea, was that a lot of us that ended up in the international adoption pool were not put there willingly by our biological families. And so it does bring up the fact that international adoption is a business like any other business. But the cost is a human life cost more than other businesses. And it was interesting because in all of the research that I've done, I've, you know, international adoption with Korea and with China is sanctioned under the Hague Convention. And that was really interesting to me after reading Professor Johnson's book, because I'm like, wait a minute, if the Hague Convention is supposed to exist to promote leaving children with their biological families or leaving them in country, how is it that the U.S. is authorizing these adoptions from Korea and from China under the circumstances in which they know that governments are not providing the full story, or under a situation where there is so much fallacy in these abandonment reports?
So what do you think should happen with international adoption? Do you have a firm conclusion about it?
I actually don't have a firm conclusion. I'm under the opinion that when I was younger, I always knew that I wanted to adopt from China, because I felt that it was a way for me to give that opportunity to another child, but not in the saving them sense, but just as something that felt right for me, because I wanted to be able to give them the chance at the education that I received and the healthcare that I received. But also, I felt that if I adopted them, then I could provide them a better sense of the culture and the history and the chance to speak Mandarin. Like, I'm really glad that my parents wanted me in Chinese language classes when I was younger, but they don't speak Chinese at home. So I'm fortunate enough that we had lots of family friends from different parts of China. My occupational therapist was from Hong Kong, so she included a lot of cultural things into my therapy. So we did lots of Chinese cooking. And that was fun, and that was a great way for me to learn about the culture, but it wasn't enough of learning about the culture. And I feel like that's probably as much as an adoptive parent can provide, not being from the country themselves. But I, at this point, after reading Professor Johnson's research and knowing more about the situation, I've come to the conclusion that I'm not sure I want to support a system that sanctions such behaviors from a government, or from, I guess, really from two governments, because the U.S. is saying that this is a perfectly normal and okay thing to do by the Chinese government.
Yeah, and of course, what Hague was supposed to do is to make sure, at least it's a voluntary sort of international agreements among countries, that adoptions are as free of corruption as possible. So the idea of Hague was to acknowledge to some extent these issues that we're talking about, but certainly they haven't been eliminated. It seems like the China program is slowing down a lot. There are very few placements of quote-unquote healthy children. Children on the waiting child list are still being placed, but I think even those are slowing down. Do you wonder if it's going to kind of halt on its own as China also develops and changes? And now there are campaigns in China, you know, girls are good, and kind of working against the prevailing kind of gender narratives that we haven't talked much about, but are also part of the story. If it all kind of came to a stop on its own, how would you feel about that?
I don't think that international adoption from China coming to a full standstill is the answer. Apart from the gender narratives, which Professor Johnson also addresses in her book, saying that really this gender narrative is not actually the way that mainstream media presents it, that because a lot of children are quote-unquote hidden, that they don't exist in the official population record, so it looks like the gender is really skewed. But Professor Johnson found that a lot of those hidden children do make it back into the population setting in like middle school or high school. So really, it's not really as skewed as it's portrayed to be. And this preference for girls is not nearly as strong as it appears to be either. It's just that because you need a hukou to be counted as part of the population and to benefit from the services that the government provides, those people are just missing from the population, thus the census numbers and things are skewed.
And if I can interrupt, and that a lot of those hidden children are girls, is your point, correct? That
a lot of them are, but not all of them. And I think also that when I was in China, I was, because I wasn't receiving physical therapy and stuff like I had been in the U.S. for my condition, I had started looking into acupuncture in the U.S. before I went to China, and we decided that that was a good enough way for me to maintain my physicality while I was in China. So I was doing that, and actually the doctor that was performing acupuncture on me, I had an interesting conversation with her about whether she thought Western medicine was better than Chinese medicine. And she was saying it depends on the condition that you're trying to treat. And she was saying that for something like cerebral palsy, where it is, you know, neurological and things like that, traditional medicine is better in the sense that because traditional medicine is more focused on rebalancing the normal energy flows throughout the body and those types of neurological signals that get disrupted, that in conjunction with Western medicine is actually the best practice. So I think you asked, you know, what is my opinion if China changes? I think if China sets up more of an infrastructure medically and socially to be like the Western countries, where having a disability isn't so inhibiting to your ability to live, then the need for international adoption is removed. But until that happens, there are still so many children that are in SWIs and other facilities that are disabled, and at this point, their better option is to be placed elsewhere. And that's just because socially, the Western countries have more of a place for that. I'm not saying it's a perfect place, because I could go on about that, but I'm not going to. But it's at least more socially acceptable, and it's not as debilitating in the Western countries. So I think for China to cease the need for transnational adoption, their entire society would have to change, and that's not something I foresee happening quickly, if at all.
Well, that's a very nuanced and interesting answer. Yeah, that certain things, and I for what it's worth, I tend to agree with you. I think these are very complicated conversations, and there's it's easy to kind of rush to the barricade with either or responses, but I think they demand more nuanced thinking. So maybe your future holds some role in all of this. You may decide to adopt from China, you may not, but I hear somebody who's got some big ideas about maybe helping a transition that needs to happen. Is there anything that we have not discussed that you want to address?
Of right now. I think we have really covered the majority of my experiences and the majority of my current thought of adoption from where I stand in my own adoption story and in my own adoption journey and just in my life in general. And this has been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me too, and I just want to confirm that you understand you're being recorded, and that once you listen to this interview, and if you approve the edited version, however you want to edit it, of this interview, that you're consenting to have it uploaded on Our China Stories.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.